is again Professor Dupree of varied departments, who will be speaking to us tonight about that wonderful poet, John Milton, who isn't living with us now, but might have been. And we're looking at texts, some of which are a little bit unusual, but it would fit in with one of the strands of what we're doing in the course, which is to say, paying a certain attention to, well, various kinds of spectacle, I suppose you could say, the dramatic art in various of its manifestations. And so it will hopefully link up with some of the other things that we're doing. Next week, of course, is the evening on Monet, and I don't have any special questions for you. I'll be giving that talk. But, you know, read the plays carefully and think about them, think about the characters, about the plots, about the things that the people say, and so forth. And then, presumably, then you'll have something to say. We'll have something to say to each other. I have not gotten back to the people who have gotten in touch with me about their topics since the general message that I sent in the email. But I know that you've talked, you sent me things, and I'll be getting back to you. So I'll update that list of people who have gotten me their topics and so forth. I would say, tell me anything. Tell me everything. Tell me everything you know. That is to say, if you know only the general topic, then you tell me that. If you know, I'm going to be this specifically, I'm going to be looking at these books, well, you know, tell me that. Later on, in 2 or 3 weeks' time, when you do another progress report, then I'll want to know everything you've done up to that point, and so forth. Was there a question, sir?
Yeah, should I, even though I asked you about my topics, I should send it to you?
Send me an email to me, anyway. The mind doesn't have mountains, it has pits. My mind does. And, all right, other things that we need to be worrying about. Don't know. At any rate, sit back alertly and enjoy. And thank you.
If you looked early for the assignments that are listed for today on Blackboard, you will have noticed that they have grown. These are not assignments exactly. They're additional information that you might find useful, because in the first half of this evening, I'm going to talk about a subject that doesn't come up too much, even in English literature, and that is the mask, and what a mask is, and why Milton wrote one, and what it means that he wrote one, and whether or not he wrote one, because some scholars don't think that the work that we call Comus, but which Milton and everybody until 1734 called A Mask Presented at Ludlow Castle. Someone said that calling A Mask Presented at Ludlow Castle Comus is like calling Othello Iago, or calling Paradise Lost Satan, although the romantic poets, some of them thought it really should be called Satan, but nevertheless. All right, so among other things, I have an excerpt from this book, which is a score for a mask by the poet, musician Thomas Campion in 1611, and he's provided a great deal of music in the guise of scores. I used it, however, mainly for pictures today, and there's a world classics edition of Court Mask that's a handy anthology of some of the mask of the period. And I'll explain in a minute what a mask is. But first, I want to talk a bit about the main figures who are important for Milton. As we'll see, they are not necessarily in order of importance, but certainly important. They are Dante, the Bible, of course. Milton, by the way, not only knew Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, but also Syriac and Italian. And he wrote sonnets in Italian. And as a young man, he took a trip to Italy and went to Rome and Venice and Florence, and around Rome and Florence. And there, he would have met a number of musicians involved in an interesting experiment. And this experiment is something that we'll talk about later on this semester. In about 4 weeks, I'll be talking about the emergence of opera. And one of the reasons that I chose to do Comus in addition to Paradise Lost this evening was to connect with the later lecture on the development of Western music from 1600 to 1750, that is to say, the movement from the invention of opera to the invention of the symphony. But I'll leave that for later. I'd like to ask you a question to start with. How many of you have had a course in which you studied Milton? Show of hands. Or maybe I should put it another way. How many of you have never had a course in which you studied some Milton, however little? I'm not surprised. Well, okay.
Different colleges. Sorry.
Still not surprised. Not these days, anyway. How many of you have studied Paradise Lost previously, either read it or in class? Okay. How many of you have read Comus previously? Wow, one person. Was it in a class?
Yes.
Ah, okay. Makes sense. It's not the sort of thing you'd read on your own, which is why I decided to do it. It's a rather early piece. But there's a second reason that I chose to do it, a third reason, really. I chose it to connect up mask with opera and music as it emerges in a different form in the early 17th century. The other reason is that it connects us up with the dramatist in Milton. We don't often think of Milton as a dramatist, but he did write one tragedy in the form of a Greek tragedy. He also wrote a poem that he compared with the Book of Job. And as you know, the Book of Job is a book that is in some sense dramatic, or at least dialogical. That is, it consists of speeches for the most part. And I want to get into this a little bit later, because Milton is a poet who is first and foremost, no matter what he writes, dramatic. And there's good reason for that. His father was one of the trustees of the Blackfriars Theater, in which Shakespeare acted and for which he produced plays, and which was the indoor theater that corresponded to the outdoor theater called the Globe. And so Milton has a very firm theatrical background, despite, or perhaps we should say, notwithstanding his Puritanism. But he was a weird Puritan. He was not a typical Puritan. The more you study Milton's Puritanism, you wonder if that term has any meaning applied to Milton, because he was as heretical a Puritan as he would have been heretical a Catholic, say, or for that matter, a member of the Church of England. Well, let's begin this evening. Let's see, I think I'll just minimize this in case we need it later. And let's go to Milton on Shakespeare. Now, I haven't put this online, but I will certainly. This is the earliest published poem of John Milton. He wrote it when he was not quite 22, and it was published in the second folio of Shakespeare, that is to say, the second edition of Shakespeare's plays. Not bad for a young poet who wrote his first important poem at the age of 22, his first published poem. Now, he had written other poetry, some in Latin, one or two in Greek, and some in English, but this is his first published poem. The important thing to note about this published poem is that it sets the agenda for the rest of Milton's career. Quite simply. I wish I had done that when I was 21. Well, actually, I did do that when I was 21. I'm still doing what I set the agenda for at 21. But it wasn't being a great poet, alas. It was just being a run-of-the-mill professor. What needs my Shakespeare for his honored bones, the labor of an age in piled stones, or that his hallowed relics should be hid under a starry pointing pyramid. Dear son of memory, great heir of fame, what needs thou such weak witness of thy name? Thou in our wonder and astonishment hast built thyself a lifelong monument. For whilst to the shame of slow endeavoring art thy easy numbers flow, in other words, he didn't have any trouble writing a lot and writing well, and that each heart hath from the leaves of thy unvalued book, that is, invaluable book, those Delphic lines, therefore prophetic, with deep impression took, then thou our fancy of itself bereaving doth make us marble with too much conceiving. In other words, if you think of Shakespeare's accomplishment, he becomes Gorgon-like and turns you to stone. This is a nice Baroque conceit. You're absolutely frozen with admiration and perhaps with envy as you look at Shakespeare's achievement. And so, sepulchred in such pomp dost lie that kings for such a tomb would wish to die. So the idea here is that Shakespeare's book, the folio, that contains not quite all, but most of his plays, is itself a monument. He has a modest tomb in the church at Stratford-upon-Avon, but his real monument is his book. But besides that monument, his even greater monument is the astonied, or astonished, turned to stone, admirers. Right, so first and foremost, Milton has in mind the dramatist. However, throughout the Renaissance and up through the 17th and well into the first half of the 18th century, it was felt that the most important thing a poet could do was to write an epic. The epic poem was the ne plus ultra of poetic accomplishment. However, those poems that might have counted as epics were not quite there. For example, one could look back at Edmund Spenser's Faery Queen, written in the 1580s and 1590s, but it was unfinished. Spenser finished 6 of the 12 books he'd intended, and in some respects, it's not at all a classical epic, but what could be called an allegorical romance epic of sorts. However, Spenser was an important model for Milton because he was the most prominent Protestant poet up to that time. Furthermore, Spenser did a number of things that we'll look at later that influenced Milton's style. Milton wrote a good number of sonnets, and he wrote another poem now that I'm just going to read you the first lines from. I'm not going to display it. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't scroll up here, did I? Shame on me. You had no idea what I was saying. So the Delphic lines does make us marble with too much conceiving. You know, conceiving here means imagining. The word conceit and the word conceive are common words. They come from the same root. And the word conceit in this period means not what we mean by conceit, as in I'm conceited, but it means an image or an idea, especially a fanciful image or idea. And so we get the metaphysical conceit. But conceit also means concept. So it's a wide-ranging world. And to conceive here also means, of course, what we too still mean by conceiving, to give birth to something. Too much conceiving, trying too hard to give birth to poetry. A couple of years later, Milton wrote a poem that was set to music a number of times, called At a Solemn Music. It's a poem about music. Now, music, next to drama, turns out to be a very important motif throughout Milton's career. As we'll see in Comus, it meets a kind of ideal union in Milton's verse and Henry Law's music, but we'll get to that shortly, 2 years after At a Solemn Music. Blessed pair of sirens, pledges of heaven's joy. Now, who are they? Sphere-born, harmonious sisters, voice and verse. Now, here, the word voice means a number of things, but principally it means singing. Singing and verse. Lyric poetry is so called because, of course, it was accompanied by the lyre. And it is said that all Greek music and most Greek lyric poetry, and even Greek epic poetry, and most Roman lyric poetry was not meant to be read, but to be sung. So the association of poetry with music is a very old one. And here again, he asks voice and verse, the blessed pair of sirens. Remember, sirens lure you in. But these are two muses, and not just sirens. Wed your divine sounds, and mixed power employ dead things with inbreathed sense, able to pierce, and to our high-raised fantasy, that is imagination, present that undisturbed song of pure conceit. So it's a little invocation to the muses. By the way, many, many years later, well, centuries, really, Ray Vaughan Williams set this poem to music. It's a very lovely piece. But what Milton talks about in this poem towards the end is a notion that goes way back to antiquity, the notion that music and harmony are an expression of the very heart of the cosmos, that music, vibrations, are simply the local version of the order that keeps all the planets and stars in their proper places and in their proper movements. So when you studied theoretical music or music theory in this period and earlier, you didn't study chords and the sorts of things we study now. You studied the harmony of the spheres. You studied the way in which voice and verse connect you with the largest aspects of the universe. So here we have in Milton's lyric voice, then, and his musical voice, the connection from his shortest poems to his most ambitious and longest poems. And with voice and verse, we also have the connection with theater and the drama and the dramatic. Now, Milton became acquainted with a musician, a composer and singer and musician, who is sometimes said to be the chief writer of songs between John Dowland, D-O-W-L-A-N-D. I know most people say Dowland, but we know from his Latin motto, John Dowland, always sorrowing, because he was a sort of musician of what you might call the Elizabethan blues. Anyway, Dowland is a delightful composer, and his contemporary Thomas Campion. Campion is important not simply because he was a major minor poet, but also he was a musician himself, one of the rare instances of somebody who did both voice and verse. Campion, by the way, was also the composer of a number of masques, and in fact, here is an edition with scores of the Lord's Masque from 1611 that Thomas Campion did. But that's by the by. Milton wrote a sonnet to Henry Lawes. Now, it was Henry Lawes who was the musician who composed the songs, the five songs, for the masque presented at Ludlow Castle. I had not heard these songs until Monday. I knew about them, but I'd never bothered to sit down and play them. They are not, to my knowledge, recorded anywhere. But it seemed to me that it was important, in view of this musical theme that's so important to Milton, to hear them. So first, let us look at, as soon as I can find the, there it is, let us look at Milton's sonnet to Henry Lawes. L-A-W-E-S, by the way. He had a younger brother, William, who died in the Civil Wars in the 1640s, unfortunately, whom most musicologists consider to have been the superior composer. But Henry Lawes wrote over 452 songs that have survived. And a few years ago on a grant, I went around trying to track some of them down and see if I could get copies. Most of them have not been published. They're still only available in manuscript. So you have to do some real scholarly digging to get to them. Both Lawes' brothers set a number of important English poets during the period. William Lawes set poems of Herrick. They were friends at Cambridge. And Henry Lawes, besides setting the songs for Comus, set songs for Edmund Waller and a whole raft of 17th century lyric poets. By the way, I should mention this, you may not know that there are a number of contemporary settings of John Donne's poetry. You would not think that most of those poems would be that singable. They're really more attuned to conversation than to song, but nevertheless, there they are. Harry, whose tuneful and well-measured song first taught our English music how to span words with just note and accent, not to scan with Midas ears, committing short and long. Thy worth and skill exempts thee from the throng, with praise enough for envy to look wan. To after age, thou shalt be writ the man that with smooth air couldst humor best our tongue. Thou honorest verse, and verse must lend her wing to honor thee, the priest of Phoebus' choir, that tunes their happiest lines in hymn or story. Dante shall give fame leave to set thee higher than his Casella, whom he wooed to sing, met in the milder shades of purgatory. What is this sonnet about? Any idea? What's Milton saying? I'm afraid in order to understand what Milton is saying, you have to have a bit of music history. You also have to have read the Purgatorio of Dante. Who's Casella? Anybody remember or know? Let me venture a guess. No? Well, Casella was a contemporary of Dante's and a musician who had died before Dante. And in the Purgatorio, Dante meets him early on at the beginning of his journey up the Mount of Purgatory. And he sees Casella and they embrace as old friends. And Dante says, "You used to delight me when you were alive with your song. Sing me something, Casella." And Casella sings a song of Dante's. That is, Casella wrote the music and he used Dante's words. So this is very apt, you see. It's a compliment that Milton pays to his friend that is not unlike the compliment that he pays to Shakespeare. but this is a compliment paid to a friend in collaboration, not to an influence. But the opening lines, oh, I did the same thing, didn't I? I am absolutely incorrigible. So Dante shall give fame leave to set thee higher than his Casella, whom he wooed to sing, met in the milder shades of purgatory. So I'll post these on Blackboard for you after this evening. A few things here. Whose tuneful and well-measured song first taught our English music how to span words? What is he talking about? Well, you have to know that in the 1590s and around 1600, 1610, some English poets, including Thomas Campion, this man, experimented with quantitative verse. In other words, they tried to write unrhymed English verse that was like Latin and Greek verse, in that it used not rhythm, iambic pentameter, stressed and unstressed syllables, but it used short and long syllables, da, 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 and so on, like the classical pentameter or hexameter. So you can do this in Latin and Greek because the vowels and the consonants have a definite differentiation between a long syllable that takes longer to pronounce and short syllables that don't take as much. Well, as it turns out, it doesn't work in English. And in fact, much of the attempt to establish a quantitative verse in English was based on the way English was spelled, not on the way it was pronounced. So as a result, it didn't work. Thomas Campion did write a treatise, however, on quantitative verse. And he did some experiments, one of which, Rose-Cheeked Laura Come, is an interesting experiment, but if it works, it's not because it's in quantitative verse at all. It's because it still follows the English stress pattern. So in English, we count stresses. We don't count syllables exactly, and we certainly don't worry about whether they're long or short. They're emphasized or not emphasized. And this is what Milton is referring to, saying you don't try as a composer to follow that blind alley of quantitative setting in your musical settings. Instead, yeah, he wasn't the first to teach English composers how to set music to English in that way, but Milton pays him the compliment of being a great innovator. And as we'll see in Comus, he is an innovator, I think, at least in the English-speaking world. By the way, the late Marshall McLuhan once remarked to me that you could never have had rock and roll in a language other than English. And I think he's right. Or jazz. These are musical rhythms that are part of the stress system of English that have nothing to do with quantity and counting syllables. So how to span words with just, that is, exact note and accent, you see? So Milton is saying, you caught on. You figured out how to compose music that respects the character and the rhythm of the English language. This is what this is all about. So committing long, short and long, but with accent. And by the way, Midas, you remember, got ass's ears because he preferred the music of the god Pan, who had his panpipes, to that more sublime of Apollo. And so there's also the reference to Midas is saying, you know, these other attempts are clunky, as it were. They're not very good. And so since you have honored verse by making English verse sound right when it's sung, so verse must lend you her wing. I have to praise you. All right, so let us back up here now. So the point that Milton is making in this instance is that Henry Laws did something special, and I think he's thinking particularly of Comus, because I don't know that Laws composed music for any of Milton's other songs. And so he did something special in Comus. And we want to work back now for a moment and see what that is. And what I want to bring to your attention is precisely what the nature of that change was that defines Baroque music. And I'll talk about that in greater length later on. I recognize a few of you who were in the Renaissance world. How many of you can remember anything at all from my online lecture on Renaissance music? Anybody? Anybody want to admit to it? Okay. In that lecture, I tried to explain that during the course of music history, from the Middle Ages up to the end of the 16th century, the movement is away from a practice in which words served the music to a practice in which the music underpinned and served the words. Right? And it is that shift around 1600 that gives rise to the Baroque style in music. In other words, the verb, words, become paramount. Music is subservient to the text. And this was how opera was born, but that's later. Right now we're going to talk about something that is rather more like the Broadway musical, or as my colleague Patrick Kelly in the drama department once put it, like a Las Vegas show. That is, the mask is rather more of an extravagant entertainment than a drama in the sense that we usually think of it. Shakespeare never wrote a mask, but he included masks, or at least representations of masks, in some of his plays. The most famous of these is The Tempest. And in The Tempest, you may recall, there is a wedding between a prince and the daughter of a duke. What do you call the daughter of a duke? Is there a name for that? You get further down the line and we don't have names for you. But in any case, a prince and the daughter of a duke, Prospero's daughter and Ferdinand, who is the son of the king of Naples. And for that wedding, he stages a magical mask. But there are other mask-like elements in The Tempest. There are songs that, in effect, are straight out of the mask. And two of these settings for Ariel's songs survived. They were by a composer. He was a court composer who also worked for the theaters, by the name of Robert Johnson, not to be confused with the 20th century blues musician Robert Johnson. And Robert Johnson's setting for Where the Bee Sucks, There Sucks I, and Full Fathom Five, those two survive. And here's what they sound like. Now, it's a lovely melody, and the melody expresses perfectly Ariel's mood at being released from servitude to Prospero. And by the way, if you haven't noticed, it's very clear that this song influenced Milton's attendant spirit, and there's no guesswork at all, I think, involved in seeing a very definite influence of the Tempest on Comus generally. No doubt about it. Comus is a kind of more attractive Caliban, and you could say that the young lady is a kind of version of Miranda. But be that as it may, notice that in this lovely melody, the emphasis is really on the melody. The melody is what expresses the meaning here, but there's not an attempt to match the movement of the notes exactly to the meaning of the words. In a cowslip's bell I lie. You go up on cowslip. There's no particular reason to go up on cowslip other than perhaps emphasis. But this meant that in the Elizabethan period, because you had a range of different verse types that would also fit a range of different melodies, you could substitute different texts for the words in a popular song. And a lot of the songs in Shakespeare's plays, by the way, simply were words that were a sort of resetting of familiar songs. You could say they're almost parodies, except they didn't have a parodic intention. So you take a popular song or popular melody and put new words to it. Or Shakespeare could write a song and then you could find a melody that fit it. You know, this is not unusual. Can you think of a very famous national anthem that was once a drinking song and was set to a poem? To Anacreon in heaven. Yeah. So it was a drinking song in the 18th century, To Anacreon in Heaven. And it turned into a national anthem. Who would have thought it? Every time I hear the Star Spangled Banner, it makes me want to hold my glass high. But anyway, To Anacreon, you know, who's a poet? So what is the mask? Well, the origins of the mask in England and in Europe generally go very far back. We know that there were royal entertainments even in the time of Richard II. In 1377, for example, we have accounts of not a mask exactly, but of a kind of entertainment that involved costumes and music and a measure of extravagant display. The best way to define what a mask is to say that it was a private entertainment for the upper classes, and usually at its center, if it was performed at court, it was performed for the monarch. And the monarch then was the center of attention for the mask. It could be said that the mask was really for the monarch and everybody else was just allowed to watch. The monarch got the best seat in the house. And the stage settings were all designed to work because around 1600 or so, we get the first illusionistic stage settings in England. The perspectival settings worked only for the monarch, who was sitting dead center front row. And the rest of the people sitting off to the sides didn't see the perspective effect as well. The illusion wasn't as complete for them. But they saw the illusion through the monarch. Now, this has a certain political ring about it, and in fact, little wonder. The mask is highly political. It was an entertainment for the aristocracy and the nobility and the gentry that was meant to, on the one hand, compliment them, and on the other hand, to remind them of the ideal that they should aim for. So the mask were highly allegorical. Now they had evolved over the centuries from a number of things. In the medieval world, there were tournaments. Tournaments were the places where the nobles showed, and the knights showed their prowess in a demonstration of skill in battle, but then also they dedicated themselves to a particular lady. Gradually, they did away with the physical stuff, and they turned it into a spectacle or a display tournament, but they still honored the ladies. And that merged with another practice that begins around the late Middle Ages, the mummer's play, a somewhat more popular entertainment. But the mummer's play involved professionals or quasi-professionals who dressed up in costumes of various sorts. And there were characters. The mummer's plays usually involved a kind of tournament, and a central figure was the figure of the doctor, who then came in and healed the wounded with his magic and medicine. Right? So the magic and medicine business then gets allegorized into the monarchy. The monarch becomes the doctor who's responsible for curing the ills of society, for bringing about peace, for resolving conflicts, and for honoring the virtuous lady. This word virtue is terribly important. In Milton's case, he's thinking of Plato, but in Plato, the word that we translate by the Latin virtus, from vir in Latin, or vir, meaning man. Virtus means manliness. But arete means moral excellence, or in Homer, it means excellence in battle, or excellence in what you do. So virtue gradually changes meaning over the centuries, but in Plato, in any case, arete is redefined from a warlike capacity to a moral excellence. And it retains that meaning subsequently, except that virtue now has become attached mostly with, well, sexuality, ultimately, in some way or another. A virtuous woman in the 16th and 17th centuries would have been virtuous in the modern sense, but she would have been virtuous in other ways as well. She would have been a possessor of moral excellence, and she would have been a model, not only for all women, but for all of mankind. Right, so this notion of virtue is very prominent during this whole period. Well, as these two ideas merge, the idea of the costumed characters and the transmogrification of physical conflict into the idea of excellence and the maintenance and the responsibility of the highest social classes towards the lower classes and towards one another, then gets encapsulated in the mask. So the mask, on the one hand, is a kind of allegorical preachment. But the interesting thing about it is that the mask was not acted by professional actors at all. It was acted by the nobility. Well, all right, there were a few professionals on stage, the singers and dancers and so on. But the roles were taken by the nobility. And in the case of King Charles I and Queen Henrietta, the monarch and the queen actually appeared in these masks. Now, this is a very select audience. It consisted of the most important people in the court, the nobility and the aristocrats, and a few high-placed officials and envoys and ambassadors from other countries. So it was a big, big deal to be invited to one of these. And we have a few accounts from people like the Venetian ambassador, or the Florentine ambassador, or a French ambassador, and a German ambassador that give us a kind of summary account of what they saw on that evening. The masks were unbelievably extravagant. The actual performance could last up to 2 hours. And by the way, there's not much of a plot here. It's almost always light against darkness. and there's no real tension in the mask. It's not dramatic in the way that we normally think of the dramatic. It tends to be, rather, a kind of playing out of certain things that we already know have to happen. So, if you will, it is musical, not dramatic. In other words, we have a theme and variations on it, and it plays out towards a resolution. I thought you might be interested in seeing some examples of images that have survived from various masks. Now, this is the, these are portraits of the Count Palatinate, that is one of the German entities, and a princess, daughter of James I. And their wedding ceremony was held in 1608, and there were three major entertainments presented for that. One was Campion's The Lord's Mask, and the other was Shakespeare's Tempest, because it was performed both in the public outdoor theater and in the private theater. And in this case, this wasn't even a private theater. This was a special performance as part of a very important union of an English princess and a German count, a very prominent German count. He has his own county, as they would have said then, his own kingdom, as it were, his own duchy. Right, so it's rather interesting to see that these two are in the same place. Here is an image of a an African, a daughter of night, presented in these rich robes. Now, one of these masks in the time of James I cost 3,000 pounds. 3,000 pounds. Doesn't sound like a lot of money, does it? Ha. 50 pounds a year was a very comfortable income in this period. So multiply that by 60. What's a comfortable income now? You know, something not extravagant, but good enough. What? 40,000, say. Okay, so think, that's $2.5 million. And these masks, a lot of it went in the sets and the costumes, because of course they didn't pay the nobles who acted in them. They did have to pay the musicians and the composers and the rest. But it was mostly costumes and sets. And it wasn't performed in the theater. It was performed in a great banqueting hall. So all of this stuff had to be moved in and set up. And it was never repeated. The masks were a one-time performance. And that was it. 3,000 pounds. $2.5 million. Little wonder that there were certain qualms about this kind of expenditure of state funds later on. But it gives you an idea of the prominence of this whole business. So here is a messenger of Apollo. Maybe I should drop the view just a tiny bit. There, that helps. Yeah. This is a, actually this is a figure of a young woman holding a musical instrument. Here is an arch and an entrance to a palace that's part of a set, and there are more designs down here. This is an American Indian, because it was full of exotic things. You know what that is? It's a turkey. It's a drawing for a costume of a man dressed as a turkey. Works well with the American Indian. And you might have a little trouble recognizing this unless you look at the tail. It's a fish. Yeah, that's the mouth. There's the tail. The tail comes down like this. And this is a dwarf, an evil dwarf on a horse. And his feet are down here so he can move. So they have these elaborate costumes. This is a priest of Apollo. And so on and so forth. I think the costumes give you a pretty good idea of the nature of the court mask. Here is a lady dressed in a very expensive gown. I'm in the course of paying for an impending wedding, and I've become very, very aware of the cost of expensive gowns that are worn only once. So I appreciate the mask all the more. Here are some harpists. The harps are playable, I suppose, but they're probably more in the line of props. And here's a very fancy headdress. And here is a man dressed in feathers. This is a design for an illusionistic set. So you can see two castle towers over here. And here is a perspectival set. And this is what the king would have seen. These were designed by Inigo Jones, who was a collaborator with Ben Jonson and many others, and he became the preeminent designer of stage settings for masks during this period. And this is how it would have worked. You see, these are all flats, and they're on grooves, and they slide in and out. And each of these is a series of about 8 different painted canvases, and they could be slid in and out to change the scene. And they probably had some smoke or some sort of flash of light that disguised the change of scene. So you saw smoke or a big flash of light, and then the scene changed. So the magical aspect that goes all the way back to the Mummers plays and even the tournaments survives in the mask, and you can see it in Comus as well. This is a floor plan of the banqueting hall, and this is the area in which the mask would have taken place. There are pillars, columns all around here. The audience would have sat behind these and around here, and they would have built a temporary stage out here for the spectacle. Now, as time wore on, this is not English, but Italian. This is an intermezzo, and it gives you some idea of the seating arrangement. And you notice that the stage then flows over into the seating area. And that was true for the mask as well. And finally, this is kind of interesting. Let's see if I can enlarge it enough for you to be able to see what it is. It's the diagram of the seating of the orchestra in a diamond configuration. And this is from about the 1620s. And you notice here the name of William Laws, and here the name Lanier, and down here, Henry Laws. So they were very early on involved in the professional production team that put on masks. They were musicians at working. Huh?
Was the Italian intermezzo, I guess, the Italian version of masks?
Similar. Now, the difference is in part that the English mask was influenced in stage designs by Italian models, and the music was influenced by Italian models, but they really all evolved somewhat separately as royal entertainments. One thing that happens in the English mask is that all of this illusionistic business and spectacle, in a sense, dissolves at the end, because remember, they're masked, they're wearing costumes, because they're all people you know, if you're in the audience. But at the end of the mask, there was the revels, which could take 3 hours. At the end of the mask, the noble characters come down from the stage and they choose dancing partners from the audience. And the whole mask dissolves into a kind of participatory ritual that turns into the revels. During the time of Ben Jonson, who's the most important of all the mask writers, that is, the composers of text during this period, he introduced something called the anti-mask. So the anti-mask was played by professionals, and it was both anti, A-N-T-E, in that it came before the main mask, and anti, A-N-T-I, in that they represented the forces of tomfoolery and even evil. And so you get in Milton, what happens in Comus is that you get the merging of the anti-mask and the mask. But first there was the anti-mask, which would have satyrs or clowns or lowly people or villains or whatever, and they're defeated. And then you move on to the mask. And then at the end of that, the aristocratic actors and perhaps singers and dancers even in the mask then came out into the audience, and the audience and the mask became merged into one. The reality, the illusion of reality, becomes the reality of illusion. I mentioned that Ben Jonson wrote a great number of masks, and it was Ben Jonson who elevated the mask to a literary form. And in fact, got into a few bits of trouble here and there as a consequence. Now, one of the musicians, there are two musicians that Jonson worked with. One was an Italian by the name of Ferrabosco, and the other was an Englishman of French extraction by the name of Nicholas Lanier. And I thought you might like to hear just one of Lanier's settings of one of the songs from Jonson's Mask of 1622, called The Mask of Augurs. Now this is still very much in the Renaissance style. Much mask sentiments, you can see. And here's the prince, Prince Charles, who's singing to his father, James I. just look at those lines for just a moment. You can see what's happening here. So this song, the reverence of their peace. So the people will respect the monarch because he brings them peace, and foreigners, strangers, will see the glories of James's reign by the increase, by the prosperity that comes out of this peace. And your princely singer, because this is Charles, Prince Charles, who is singing on stage, and his father is front and center. Your princely singer here, your son, do by his father's light his courses run. In other words, I aspire to be like you, my father. Now, is this all fiction? Oh, yes. Come on. You know. But it is the ideal, then, that is constantly put forward by the aristocracy to the aristocracy, both as justification for their being aristocracy and to remind themselves that as a result of the accident of being aristocracy, they are not free to do anything they want. They have very definite duties and obligations. So it's a lovely song, as a matter of fact. But now let's turn to Comus. Mm-hmm. No, the Civil War was what beheaded Charles I. Oh, did the mask. I'm sorry. Yeah, you're asking a different question. Masks in, well, first of all, they were pretty much done away with by the Puritans, but they were already pretty much moribund by the 1640s. In fact, you could say by the time Milton writes Comus, the mask is on its downslope. It's really not as important as it had been. On the other hand, the last of the Jacobean Stuart mask in 1640 was by Sir William Davenant, who lived through the period of the Commonwealth, and by the way, wrote the text of the first English opera, The Siege of Rhodes. Because for some strange reason or another, the Puritans had no trouble with opera. They just didn't like plays. But in any event, there were a few mask compositions, but there was no court to perform them in. Now, I've said court again and again, but by the way, prominent noble families with large estates also presented masks, either when the monarch was visiting them, the monarch and the court paid a visit, then they would stage masks, or they would stage masks on their own. That is, they remind themselves of their social obligations. As a matter of fact, you know, the nobility who lived out in the countryside were, as a matter of fact, obligated to serve the entire community that surrounded the great house. Well, by the time we get to Ludlow Castle and the Bridgewater family, Henry Lawes is a friend of the Bridgewaters, and he is asked to compose one of these family entertainments, as it were. We don't know why, but he chose a young 25-year-old poet who had not yet written his most famous early poem, though he had written several. He had written a few sonnets. He had written a very interesting nativity poem called On the Morning of Christ's Nativity. That is the first sign of his coming maturity as a poet. But he hadn't written Lycidas, which is Milton's most famous lyric poem, quite yet. That's 1637, 3 years later, the same year in which the mask presented at Ludlow Castle is published. Well, what did Lawes do? First of all, it seems that Lawes was the producer and the main actor and singer and the conductor and the composer of the music. and he approached the young John Milton, who was still at Cambridge University. Whoa, I leaned on something. Oh, I see, it was a keyboard. Sorry about that. A little warning. He was the attendant spirit. And so if you look upon the attendant spirit as the magician who creates the music and who caused the whole show to exist, then you begin to get a sense of what his role is, not only in the mask, but in the whole entertainment in the evening. But what I was struck by when I first heard this music 2 days ago, I sat down a keyboard and played it, and I decided that you ought to hear it too. So I'll put these on blackboard, but here is what the first song from Comus sounded like. I found very striking about this is that it's not very melodic, is it? I mean, I can't really imagine going around humming this. It's not nearly as melodic as either the Lanier setting of Ben Jonson's poem or Robert Johnson's setting of Shakespeare's Where the Bee Sucks for Ariel. What's going on? What's going on is that Laws has made the music subservient to the text, and the music pauses at certain rhetorical points that are not good musical points, but that tell you how to read the line of verse. Now, how many of you read music, by the way? The rest of you, if you listen along, will doubtless understand what I'm talking about. Now let's see, where is it? Here it is. Okay. From the heavens, now I fly. He goes up an octave here because he's flying, right? Now they did that in the 16th century. They did it a lot in the madrigals, the famous Elizabethan madrigals. From the heavens, now I fly, and those happy climes that lie where day. The music, interestingly enough, hesitates where the verse hesitates. Never shuts, never. Now look at this. If you know music, you see a dotted eighth and a 16th. Never shuts his eye. You see, this is an unaccented syllable here, right? This is a stressed syllable. So it gets a dotted quarter note. This gets a third of its value. But shuts his are equal in value and almost equally stressed, so they get full eighth notes. And then I gets, it's the most important word here, it gets a whole note. Never shuts his eye up in the, and look, in the, see, up in the. He's following exactly the stress and accent of the music. This is just what Milton praised him for. Had this been done before? Yes. Where? Well, mostly in Italy, because the Italian composers in creating opera, developed something called recitative, which is a non-melodic, sort of chanted speaking. And we'll look at that later. But let's look at another song from Comus. Here's number two. By the way, I've set these up so if you have a video style iPod or a similar device, you can put them on it and carry them around and amaze your friends. Peculiar modulations here. Now, it occurred to me that it might be a little bit hard for you to get a sense of how the words fit with the text, and so I did something profoundly embarrassing. I took the most famous of the text and well, what do you expect? What do you expect at 9 in the morning? And my voice is not what it used to be, for sure, but it was more or less in tune and on beat. look at this last one, though. Listen and see. All right, but listen. See? Again. Listen. Listen. And this little turn on "and" is meant to delay "and" just long enough so that the word "save," it's the last word, it's the most emphatic word, but there's a kind of rhetorical effect going on here. Well, let's listen to two more. This is song number four. This is the pastoral song. Without ducker, da 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 da, you're ducking and nodding, you see. Oops, I misspelled Ryades. The noble lord and lady bride are the Bridgewaters, mother and father, of course. The three fair branches are the two boys and the young lady. What happened to my last syllable there? you notice that this is very similar to the song said by Lanier for Johnson, in that the whole point, from the Bridgewater's point of view, of the mask is to celebrate the next generation. And they can be proud of this next generation because, look, in this representation of them, they have managed, or at least the girl has, to resist worldly temptations. And by the way, the song that Prince Charles sang about the king who brings peace and prosperity to his subjects, this is virtue in a prince. That's what the virtue of a prince is. That's his moral excellence. Finally, there's the concluding song, which in a way does sum up the theme of the whole mask. This is the attendant spirit, otherwise known as Ariel. So, if virtue is feeble, heaven will stoop to her. Now, what does that mean? How does heaven stoop to her? Well, this is the theme of Paradise Lost. And we'll see that in a minute. But first, I want to look at just one speech, the most famous speech in Comus, or in the Mask, that we sometimes call Comus, and that is Comus's temptation speech. So let me give you just a quick summary of the action of the mask. You could say that the mask is about the triumph of song, in a way. That is, song understood as also celestial harmony, and song as an expression, finally, of the ideal of moral excellence or virtue. So this triumph of music is attendant in the spirit played by Laws, and there is Sabrina, who is a sort of aerial figure for the attendant spirit's Prospero. Then there is the attendant spirit, he's sometimes called the daimon or daemon. He provides information for the two brothers who might have saved their sister, but they wandered off and forgot her. I had two boys and a girl myself, and this happened a lot. Where's your sister? Oh, I don't know. So I'm not surprised. So the two brothers are not yet able to mobilize the kind of knowledge or power that will defeat Comus, and they have a kind of narcissistic self-importance, as boys sometimes will, which requires grace to raise them to the level of some liberating energy from their own limitations. So there's an introduction and prologue by the attendant spirit, and the last thing we find out is that he'll disguise himself as a shepherd with his soft pipe and smooth dittied song. And this suggests another figure from mythology, that of Orpheus. And Orpheus will play a terribly important, a crucial role in the beginning of opera, Of course, that was some 34 years earlier in Italy, but that was another country. The anti-mask dance and the opening soliloquy of Comus, and it's a beautiful soliloquy, really, a very attractive one, because Comus here, by the way, Milton was clearly thinking back to a mask that Ben Jonson wrote and that was performed in the court of King James the First, called Pleasure Reconciled to Virtue. And the character who represents pleasure is Comus. But this Comus is a rather Rabelaisian Comus. Milton's Comus is a handsome young man, all the more enticing, all the more tempting to the young lady. So the entry of Comus and his crew is the anti-mask. And he argues for natural processes. Follow nature. Be natural. All these things are natural. There's nothing wrong with them. They're perfectly natural. And I represent them, especially in the freedom of night and secrecy. And so the lady's footsteps tell him that she's approaching, and he apostrophizes his magic spells. And he becomes a villager instead of a shepherd, so he's played off against the attendant spirit. Alone, the lady thinks out the meaning of error and of wandering doubt, which the wood represents, and the wood here is obviously a Dantesque kind of wood. She realizes that the danger is not to the physical body, but to the mind. And so she announces that three virtues guard her. What are they? Faith, hope, and chastity. But, and there's been a very considerable debate over this. Many years ago, Malcolm Ross wrote a book in which he said, faith, hope, and chastity. Chastity seems like a lot less than charity. But in fact, it's not simply that for Milton, chastity is a surrogate for charity, but it has unblemished form here. So it's a design, the divine principle. The lady sings her song in the hope that her voice will be heard as far away as possible, and she sings a responding tune to Echo, and her brothers are compared to Narcissus. Rather interesting. So Comus, who's been listening, wonders, can any mortal mixture of earth's mold breathe such divine enchanting ravishment? Does that sound familiar? Sound like a character in a later poem of Milton's? Ah, yes, it's Milton's Satan. And the reason I chose Comus to go along with Paradise Lost is that Comus, in fact, has precisely the same themes in many ways as Paradise Lost. And that concluding song will demonstrate it. So there's a charming debate between the two brothers. One is a skeptic and the other is hopeful, but they can't really decide what to do. In the meantime, the spirit enters disguised as Thyrsus. And, oh, I should mention that Comus is a son of Circe, right, who changes people into baser shapes. And we get, after a number of other events, Comus and the lady debate the reasons why she should accede to pleasure over virtue. She refuses, though his famous defense of pleasure is full of gay rhetoric. Not what we mean by gay rhetoric now, but anyway. The chastity of the lady, however, is far from being merely stoic. And since Comus is not able to do anything to persuade her, he immobilizes her. And then finally, the last part, the brothers and the spirit enter with the invocation to Sabrina, who then unfreezes the lady, breaks the spell, and Comus then is removed, and we get a celebration of love and chastity. But here, obviously, what is meant by chastity is not perpetual virginity, but chastity in a Christian marriage. Well, let's stop there, and now we'll turn after the break to Paradise Lost and look at how these themes of music, temptation, drama, and the heaven that stoops to earth because virtue is not strong enough to rise to heaven. So take what? What do you do? About 10, 15 minutes?
Where are we here? We usually take a longer break and then we don't have another break.
Okay.
Like 15 minutes.
Okay. See you about a quarter till then?
Okay.